told me about that was in the house.
All right. So thank you for coming here, Ludo, and having the interview.
That's okay.
So my name's Heather. It's December 12th, 2012, and I'm interviewing, if you want to just say your name.
Yes, my name is Ludo Foster.
Okay. And how old are you, Ludo?
I'm 37, okay. Getting on a bit.
And how do you identify as, do you identify as queer?
Yes, I identify as genderqueer, I suppose, in my gender expression, and on the trans masculine spectrum.
Okay, great.
So that would be my...
And where are you from originally?
I'm from South Wales, from a small valley town.
Okay.
In South Wales.
And how would you identify your class to be?
Working class, I suppose, I would say.
And we're just going to go through all of these ticks of the boxes. And how would you identify as your ethnicity?
I usually just put mixed other, because it doesn't, it kind of leaves, because I always think these forms, they, you know, I don't know, just leave it ambiguous, I guess.
Yeah.
Mixed other.
Ambiguous. Okay. And... what would you identify with any religion as part of your identity?
I usually say spiritual, and I know that's kind of quite open, but I was brought up sort of, I guess, Church of England, you know, sort of. But, yes, very spiritually open,
yeah.
With Buddhist sympathies as well. So.
Yeah. And what would you identify with an occupation or...
I'd just say kind of academic, I guess, at the moment, you know. Sort of.
You're studying for your PhD?
Yes, PhD gender studies.
Okay, and when did you come to Brighton?
It's been a while now, actually. I'm trying to think how long ago it was. It was about 3 years ago now, I suppose.
Yeah.
Time has flown, definitely.
And so you were 34 when you came?
34? Oh, yeah. That's quite frightening. Yes, that's right, though, that's right. But, yes, and I love it, actually. It's a great place to be. But before that, I lived in Winchester, so okay. I've travelled about the UK quite a bit.
Yeah.
And, yes, settled in Brighton, or Hove, I could say.
Yeah, okay. And why did you come to Brighton?
Well, I applied to come onto this course and got accepted. So, but I'd always wanted to kind of... The thought of Brighton appealed to me, and... So yes, getting accepted on this course, it's quite well respected and great for gender studies, you know. So it was just an excuse, really, to move down here then. So, and I'd never, before I came down to look for somewhere to live, I'd never been to Brighton before, so the place was really, you know, quite new to me. So, and it was winter, so not the best introduction, you know. Couldn't go down to the beach.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that was my little introduction to the place. And, yes, I'm doing a part-time PhD as well. So.
And what does being queer in Brighton, what does that mean to you?
That's quite interesting, I suppose. People think of Brighton as very much the kind of queer or gay capital, you know, sort of in the UK. Well, this is what I would tell people, and people immediately think that anyway. And so what does it mean? I'm not exactly sure what it means. I suppose you would think to be part of, you know, a kind of community, to be somewhere you can live, you know, sort of differently to other parts of the country. You do notice a difference, you know. There seems to be more of an openness, you know, in the way that people... It's probably, I'm assuming it's the same in London as well, but certainly not so much in small towns or small cities. You don't see same-sex couples holding hands or people, you know, sort of... there isn't that kind of sort of obvious queerness in a lot of places. So I guess there is a certain amount of freedom, a certain amount of tolerance. It's not perfect, but it is quite a good place to live, I think, if you do identify in some kind of queer way. There are things available and kind of more opportunities, you know. So certainly if you're in this little bubble in the university as well, you know, that kind of queer academia. So, yeah, it can mean many things, so I think, depending on who you are, you know, and sort of, you know, how you live in. A lot of people probably come here because it is so well known, actually, for its sort of historically as well, this kind of queer history, you know, sort of. And it's always a bit strange when you try to describe the place to people from other countries that mm-hmm. don't know of it. So, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not sure with you as well. Did you know about the, you know, sort of the reputation, so to speak? That, so it's kind of, you know, I don't know if that's enough, but they, you know, that would be what it means to me, I guess, a certain level of tolerance. But depending on who you are, you know, it probably isn't ideal, but it's, you know, it's close to it, really. So it's a good place to be.
Yeah. Thank you. If someone asked you about your identity or how you identify, how would you explain that in one sentence or couple sentences?
Sort of having kind of thought about it, and obviously it's very very fluid, actually. But I say sort of you know, genderqueer, transmasculine is what I say now, if people kind of want to know, and just a very fluid identity. I'm aware of the changeability as well, and I'm quite accepting of that. Yeah. Sort of very open, actually, and potentially, you know, sort of there's an ebb and flow kind of with it. And that's the way that I identify. It isn't really a fixed identity, but certainly feel very close to kind of the transgender community and the queer community, actually, in general. So, yes.
Great. Thank you. So some of the themes that the project is interested in talking with people about is sort of spaces and place and culture. So one of the questions is, what were the differences, what are the differences, you would say, between sort of your day life and your night life in Brighton?
There's quite a big difference, I mm-hmm. suppose. It is a very social place, I think, Brighton in general. And it's changed, actually, sort of over time. You discover, you know, sort of places to go. I went to the Marlborough Pub, was somewhere quite well known. And I found that to be a really sort of friendly, open kind of place. But you discover, I'm very interested now in discovering kind of quite kind of queer-friendly places, you know, not so segregated in a way, and also trans-friendly places. And there aren't so many, actually, even in a place like Brighton and maybe in the country in general. And yeah, so what was the... Sorry, can you
That's
go back
okay.
to the
yeah, sure.
question?
What are the differences between your day life and your night life in Brighton?
I would say that the day life for me is academia, a lot of study, quite a peaceful, I try, you know, kind of quite into meditation, things like that. And so there's a focus, I guess, to the daytime. And If I'm thinking night, I think of social then, more so, or a different kind of socialising. So I sort of associate that with music, with film, and a different kind of energy level, actually, sort of, and just a more... it's quite a solitary life, I think, an academic, the poor academic sort of in the garret. But it is, and so I quite like the contrast, actually, between the social... and that more peaceful, reflective. So, you know, that would be the difference, I guess, just a different pace, actually. But I think then it depends as well. I mean, you could be living a very social life, even as an academic, you know, 20, you know, sort of every day of the week. But I try to have a little bit of balance, you know, to as much as I can, just to kind of keep me focused sort of on my work and... So that would be the difference for me. And I live a little way out from the centre as well. Even within Brighton, you've got sort of the city centre, but also lots of small kind of communities then, sort of. And I live in Hove, which is a completely different pace, actually. It's slower. This is one of the things I quite like about it as well. It kind of suits me in the sense that I drive, so it's great for... getting around and parking and things like that. And I see Brighton as a sort of, almost for me, more of a summer place, you know, sort of somewhere that I associate with kind of going down to the beach and sort of walking around a lot more, getting the bus, things like that. And in the winter, kind of maybe going in there to pubs and somewhere called the Cowley Club, which is quite a sort of cool little venue that does seem to be more kind of inclusive, you know, of different identities. And or it feels like one of the closest things we've got in Brighton to this kind of thing. But it just depends what you want, I guess, for the nightlife. We've got the big kind of gay clubs like Revenge and all that kind of stuff. And so yes, there's definitely a different pace between the day and the night. So.
And during your daytime and your work, do you? I mean, you're quite unique in that your work is a sort of wrapped up in
yes,
identity.
Yes, yes.
So inevitably, you're out at work. And
yes, yeah. Yes. I think you've got the luxury. I mean, out in the sense of, you know, people aware of your gender and sort of sexual identity. I think you've got that luxury in this kind of little academic world. The people as well, for instance. One of the big things for me this year is I changed my name, you know, by deed poll, and that was noted. And as a result of that, it seemed to flag up to people that some people that they started to ask about pronoun preferences and things like that within this academic world. That isn't something you would get everywhere, you know. So I'm aware of that difference between the sort of slightly cosseted sort of quite comfortable sort of academic world and the reality, you know, of kind of being misgendered in daily life. And that can be quite difficult. So I'm kind of learning to sort of to negotiate that, I suppose, you know, sort of the madams and misses and whatever. But all these things intersect as well, you know, so it's interesting and very relevant that you have mentioned race and class, actually, because all these things connect. You know, sort of, and also if you identify as maybe more on the masculine spectrum or as masculine, there's also like an age thing as well that some people have noted, you know, sort of you tend to maybe look younger than, you know, or present as younger, possibly, maybe quite considerably younger than you actually are. So there's also that strange space to negotiate as well, you know, sort of, and those presumptions, you know, so which can be interesting. And
so if you're someone who is perceived as a female, as a masculine female, there's an age
or if maybe
assumption about your age.
Or if people think, if say you're dressed up in quite an ambiguous way and people are not hearing your voice, and they might think you're a teenage boy or something like that, you know, and that does happen occasionally, very occasionally. And so there are many different facets, you know. And I'm not sure about the masculine woman sort of identity, but I've not thought of myself, you know, not thought of people seeing me in that kind of way. But I guess they have, actually, and would do. I think it really depends. People tend to be quite polite, I've noticed, or I've not really had a lot of sort of, you know, negativity or blatant sort of negativity. But that, maybe that would be my personal experience. I don't think that's true of everyone, certainly not. But certainly, for me, it's the sort of transmasculine, genderqueer identity, and I prefer to be seen as kind of more male, you know. And but I realise at the same time, obviously, things such as voice and height and size, these are kind of feminine markers quite often, not always. So there's that having to build up a certain amount of tolerance, you know, to people making these assumptions, which can be, I mean, even with my name, for instance, within a family setting, people are great, they try to remember, but they don't always remember, you know, and they maybe use my old name. And so you decide whether it's a personal thing or it's just, you know, a mistake that anyone could make and not meant in a hurtful, you know, sort of purposeful way. So I'm negotiating these types of spaces, you know, and it's not a continual compromise, it sounds like it is, but it's just kind of having to sort of maybe be a bit more understanding. And, you know, I sometimes think of that feeling of being ahead of your time. I know that seems really arrogant, but in all kinds of ways, you know, a feeling that people will get this at some point, but not yet, they're not getting it yet. It might be a long wait, but, yeah, so.
Thank you.
Okay.
Let's see. So So you talked a little bit about some of the spaces that you feel comfortable in Brighton.
Yes.
And what are some, and you mentioned also that there are a few spaces for trans identities to have some safety or some comfort. Mm. Do you want to talk some more about those spaces and what makes those unique?
Yes, they are quite rare actually as well, even in a city like Brighton. For instance, things like the public restrooms or bathrooms, toilets, that's a big issue. And even within an academic setting, there still isn't often the option of a gender-neutral space, for instance. And if you're unpassable in the sense that you don't necessarily look male or female, depending on who you are and what you're wanting to, you know, and what you're hoping you're embodying, but not necessarily... It can be quite difficult to go in. It's not always safe to go into certain spaces, you know, if you don't look like you belong there. You know, it could be embarrassing, could be awkward, could be threatening. I think something that's unique about, say, somewhere like the Cowley Club, and that actually doesn't have neutral toilets, which they do. There are other spaces that do actually, but. What's unique about that, I think, is that there's an open-minded, people don't seem to care which one you use. It feels, just because of the ethos of the place, ideally, it sort of, there seems to be, you know, there will be like-minded people or people that will get that. But there's many spaces where you won't find that. Buying clothes is another kind of issue as well, and changing rooms and gender changing rooms and anything actually that is very overtly gendered can be really awkward. But I think it's possible to find, sometimes you have to put yourself out there a little bit to find these spaces, you know, even in everyday practical situations, say medical situations. With the doctors, I've had to change my name there, and they usually put your name up on a big, you know, get a sign sort of flashing lights, and and it's usually Mr. or Mrs. whatever, and I've changed my my title to MX, which is a gender neutral title. Mix, I think, is how it's pronounced. I think I tend to say MX, and often it can be quite difficult to get these things changed on bureaucratic forms and medical forms. But after quite a lot of perseverance, they've changed it now, and I can go in and it says MX Ludo Foster, you know, and, you know, maybe if someone else goes in the next time, they will have heard of this, it won't be so strange. So sometimes you've got to, and it's not always easy, actually, and not everybody is in such a position or a privilege, you know, not everybody has the privilege of being able to go in and fight their corner in such a way, you know, sort of... So I think that's definitely a factor. And I'm thinking of spaces that aren't so safe. They recently had a Brighton, what was that night called, with people, like a takeover, Take Back the Night, yeah. I think it was called. And there was some sort of trans inclusion in that. And I think that's also an issue, particularly for trans women. I'm really sensitive to that, actually, that's one of the biggest issues, in a way, the attacks, even in a place like Brighton, on trans women. But in general, you can feel quite... there is a level of vulnerability, you know, and yet again, that could be tied in with an ambiguity. I've got a friend, I was talking to them just recently, and they've actually... they identify as male. They've, for many years, they've gone through some kind of a process, and identify as male, and they as a result look a lot younger than they are actually. They're kind of, this is how their masculinity sort of understood. You know, they look quite, and they were saying that quite a lot of when they go out in this to be in the beginning of their transition, they would go out socially, and all of a sudden teenage boys would kind of come up to them and start being a little bit more aggressive, as if they were themselves talking to another sort of adolescent boy, you know. So there can be maybe these different... I've not experienced that, luckily, yet. But there can be these different little subtle levels of I don't know if it's danger or threat, you know, sort of just in how a person... maybe being mistaken for something, you know, and sort of So there can be those kinds of... So, yeah, certainly any space where you can feel comfortable. I don't feel quite so comfortable. I did have more of sort of... at one point, I there's a fluidity to my identity, and quite a few sort of trans guys or genderqueer people would maybe relate, but certainly not all. But I've connected myself sort of to a lesbian identity. So then maybe you inhabit those kinds of spaces, but then you start to feel differently as your identity kind of, I wouldn't say necessarily changes, but sort of maybe as you start to identify in a different way, in a more masculine way, because there can be this segregation with genders, you know, sort of for all kinds of reasons. But that can be, and I know other people have said to me as well, that they can sometimes feel pushed out of spaces they would still like to inhabit, you know, sort of. But now they're seen differently, especially if they've taken hormones, for instance. And, so I think this is one of the reasons why if I can find a space that is, you know, genderqueer, this is where I would feel more comfortable. But they are really few and far between, as far as I know, even in Brighton. So, yes, it is, it is the Cowley Club, you know, and the Marlborough, actually, even though it's known to be quite a pub that caters to a sort of a big lesbian clientele. It is pretty inclusive. They recently had a benefit. It was some months ago, but for transgender FTMs, and so it's a pretty inclusive. It feels relatively, you know, sort of comfortable, but
What about falling in love in Brighton and looking for love in Brighton? That's another interesting topic.
Okay.
In terms of talking about space.
Yes. It's a social city.
About that you went to
it's interesting. It's a social city, you know. Mm-hmm. So I would say it's easy to meet people in a kind of, in that sense, but often it can be difficult. It just depends, I guess, where you're going as well socially. You know, you can build up sort of meaningful relationships and friendships, you know, sort of, but it takes a while. And I think that as well is to do with sort of how sociable you are as well, especially if you're new to a place.
Yeah.
I actually think that Brighton, of all the places I've lived, offers the most in the sense of a opportunity for meeting many people from you know, especially in the queer sense, that can often be difficult. But I find identifying. I feel it was actually easier when I was identifying as lesbian. It was kind of easier to meet people in a strange way. It becomes a whole other issue when especially when you're between. I see myself in not necessarily between, but at a point where. When you're sort of exploring your gender identity and kind of identifying on that trans masculine spectrum, and you're at a stage where it's not necessarily new to you, but you're kind of processing all that, it can be difficult to get other people in a romantic sense as well to sort of to understand. It can seem like a very complicated identity, you know, sort of. So that, and just the general meeting people can be quite, I've known other sort of trans guys that have also said that, you know, what do you tell people, how do you want them to see you?
Mm-hmm.
People will often project onto you, you know, a lesbian identity, and, you know, and that can be quite difficult if that's not how you see yourself, you know, so meeting people, it would be great actually if they were more spaces in general. It's probably an issue all over the country, I imagine, even in a city like London. But that can be quite difficult. But there are kind of groups where people can meet. I know there's a bisexual kind of meeting group, for instance, and certainly plenty of social spaces. But I'm not always sure if pubs and clubs are a great place to you know, if you're trying to get to know someone in depth, you know. There are things like dating websites as well. I actually... When I was identifying as lesbian, I did meet a few people actually through there's a website called Gaydar Girls, and that was quite useful. But there isn't anything really like that for like trans people, you know. But I find that the internet still is quite a useful kind of quite private sort of meeting space as well and things like that. So I'm not sure about the kind of falling in love, you know, sort of, you know, I've certainly met people since I've been here and sort of had romantic, you know, sort of interests with people, but I've not found it easy necessarily to build anything lasting at this point. But there's certainly a lot of opportunity, I think, in a place like Brighton, sort of, you know, if you identify as queer, there are more opportunities than there might be in other places. But I still think online is quite a safe space as well, in a strange way, you know, depending on the groups, depending, you know, that can often be quite a good way. So, yes, I'm not sure what else to say on that.
Yeah. How have you been political in Brighton? And I think this kind of wraps up into what we've been talking about already. But in terms of gender, health, employment, safety, feminism.
I wish I'd been more overtly political, actually, but maybe I can change that. I've never been one to march and things, you know, and one of the things that I noticed, I've not really done a lot with Brighton Pride, but I noticed this year it wasn't very, and for probably maybe quite a time now, I'm quite cynical about it. The fact that it doesn't, I think my political sort of attitude extends to more global concerns than are reflected in something like Pride, for instance. Brighton Pride, I wouldn't say about other prides, but I wish I'd been maybe in some ways more involved. I'm not comfortable with the idea of marching and protesting in that sense, but I have a lot of friends that do that, but that just isn't. But politically, I just on a personal level, I vote. That's something I always like to do. I feel it's really important to use that vote, even if there is a lack of choice. Even if you just decide to sort of ruin the you know, sort of just put a protest on the thing, but to get heard in some way, and on a small level. I guess I just try to challenge things in the personal sense by trying to embody sort of what I believe in, trying to live that, trying to as I described with the doctors, you know, just informing them about this gender neutral word, doing the same with the banks. I suppose maybe this is a privilege and a luxury as well, but I because I know some people live a stealth life or have that privilege, actually. They can live on what is termed stealth, which is, you know, they present, particularly in the trans community, obviously this is relevant, if they've taken hormones, they present as male and maybe don't tell anyone that they were classified as anything other than male, you know, sort of in the world. I don't, at the moment, have that privilege, but I think I've lost my train of thought, but I do sort of have the privilege, I guess, of being able to engage with sort of institutions and to live a kind of I have the luxury that my family, for instance, and I know a lot of people don't have it, and I'm so aware that it is a luxury that my family are very accepting. You know, my mother is religious. But she's always been incredibly open and accepting about sort of LGBTQ, you know, rights. And even when others around her would be quite anti that, she's always had an attitude of take people as you find them, which has come from her own upbringing as well, which is pretty unique, actually. And I'm aware of that, coming from this working class background and you know, sort of in South Wales. And yeah, so I think that's allowed me to be able to be open with people about my gender identity, obviously choosing my moments. You obviously think of safety, personal safety, but for the most part I'm able to be open with people when I need to be and open with my family. So, but I'm aware that certainly isn't typical, you know, of a lot of people. So, so politically I kind of wish that I could get more involved in kind of global things. But I suppose as well I'm doing that in small ways by my writing, what I'm putting out there in my thesis, which is grounded in my own sort of some of my own experience and also my political different viewpoints and spiritual viewpoints. And also I'm able to kind of take that with me to if I go to conferences. And I've been lucky enough recently to attend a few conferences and workshops where I've met people in a kind of more global, international setting in Europe, but people from all over the world, and I've been able to engage more widely with what is happening, you know, and kind of get outside. This to me is the positive side of politics. I tend to shy away from, not shy away, but I purposely, I'm very cynical about the kind of the media in general, you know, the sort of mainstream media, I should say. So I'm quite choosy about what I, you know, sort of choose to engage with when it comes to stories and, you know, sort of and what is being flagged up as a kind of a, you know, I'm often very cynical and sceptical about these things and try to seek out and to become more informed, you know, about the wider picture, actually, because I was brought up with this. Without this, I didn't have such a global view of things growing up, you know, before the age of the internet and this kind of stuff. And we weren't encouraged. I presume people are encouraged a lot more in schools and things these days. But even saying that, I come from a very strongly socialist background, small town in South Wales. The politician and Eireann Bevan came from there, and we were always in my family anyway. We were Labour voters, particularly my grandfather, and we were always made very aware that, that you know, we had the pride, and we're still pretty proud of the fact the health service, for instance, the NHS, started in this small town. A working class guy, and Eireann Bevan, it was his concept, as far as I know, and he grew up not far away. You know, this was something I grew up knowing about. In the 1980s, I saw the sort of fallout when I was in school of the miners' strike, for instance, with Thatcher years. So I was aware of a lot of those changes, even if I didn't understand them. I knew that there were people whose fathers were now out of work. And so and I come from a sort of single-parent family background, brought up by my mother. There were three of us. So politically, that's informed as well my kind of my attitude, you know. So, and these are kind of things that stay with me now. But in the sense of actually going out there, and that's something I've not yet done. But I think if something will, I would look forward to maybe. I had a friend who recently, actually at the Take Back the Night, gave a short. Talk about sort of a trans, you know, what it's like to be trans in that situation, and that encouraged me. Maybe if I get the opportunity to do something like that, you know, I would feel, you know, maybe to get involved. But I suppose, you know, I'm learning and growing and changing all the time, I guess, you know, sort of when it comes. But I have this quite strong. It's interesting now I talk about it. I can see, you know, that I have this quite strong. Sort of socialist, you know, working class upbringing. So and it's kind of informs a lot of things, even when I'm not conscious of it, mm-hmm. you know. So it's kind of always there. Mm-hmm. So that's my political.
Thank you. And you were talking a bit about some, maybe not discrimination, but some of the challenges of being trans within Brighton.
Mm.
But would you describe, or would you have any examples, or have you experienced any discrimination because you identify as queer or trans or genderqueer?
I little subtle things, you know, sort of mispronouncing, and, you know, I've not had a huge amount, this is my own personal experience, but of overt, you know, homophobia or queerphobia or transphobia, I've not experienced, you know, sort of a huge amount in Brighton. I think that would be different in a small town in South Wales. I remember growing up, for instance, and you would never, it was very unusual to hear about a trans person at all. And there was a story in our local paper about a trans woman in the next town who this became a big story. They were working as a taxi driver, And because they had been in the paper, or because they were noticeable in some way, maybe just because of their presentation, they did receive a lot of, in this very small town, a lot of negativity. This would have been about 10, maybe 15 years ago now. And they were eventually forced to move from the town. Mm. And I remember at the time, because it's taken me quite a long time to sort of, you know, negotiate my own kind of identity. At the time, I wasn't sort of, I was a lot younger then and didn't seem, I remember thinking that must be really hard, but not connecting myself. But growing up, certainly in the small town, as a child that was quite androgynous because I was a short hair and I was dressed in stereotypically boyish style, I did get quite a lot of you know, teasing, name-calling, and sort of, which I found very embarrassing at the time. You know, I didn't have anything to judge it against. And, it, you know, so that. But since I've been in Brighton, actually, that's been my personal experience. I've not had any kind of, apart from the subtle things, you know, the mispronouncing, the difficulty in finding these neutral spaces and bathrooms and things like that. Never anything overt, but I don't know if I wouldn't know if that's typical, you know, maybe that's just the circles that I've moved in and the places I've been to and the people around me. I've got, my group of friends are pretty sort of, even if they don't always get it, they're quite sort of understanding and sensitive, you know, sort of, so, but I know that that isn't always the case for people and, you know, but this has been my experience, and I try to keep as safe as I can as well. You know, I've not put myself in a situation that I might feel would be, you know, sort of gone into certain pubs or clubs, you know, sort of maybe wouldn't be as accepting. So, yes, and that's been my personal experience. So,
okay. And how do you feel that language is important? And in your time in Brighton, have you changed your language around sort of how you identify or the way that you speak about queer or identity?
Yes, and I think a lot of that's been informed by the course and my research and just generally just a natural. I feel that language within the queer community does change a lot anyway, and you know that seems to be a big, you know, there are so many, and also there can sometimes be an intolerance or a lack of understanding for people that don't necessarily have that awareness, you know. So, for instance, someone said to me the other day they didn't know what cisgender meant, you know. And that's not unusual, you know. I think people can forget that these can be quite exclusive, quite, it's almost like a kind of a clique that you know, sort of where people will use these terms. And that can be a privilege thing, I think, and a kind of that can make some people feel excluded. I have access to these terms and have to have as well because of what I'm writing. And so certainly a lot of the as well, identifying as genderqueer for me is something that I've done since I've moved to Brighton, I guess, or I sort of, well, when I was in Winchester, but sort of. I've sort of cemented that more, sort of, it's become more cemented since I've lived in Brighton. And I've kind of put that out there more and told people. And obviously a lot of people have not heard of that term, but, you know, you can kind of explain to people. This is why I say transmasculine, actually, as well, because there are so many different ways of identifying, even within sort of female to male, male to female. I suppose as well, you judge the situation, you know, sometimes you maybe want to keep things simple. So people, I mean, I maybe would just say transgender if I felt someone wouldn't necessarily understand things like genderqueer. But certainly I think my use of language in that sense has changed. I always did use the term, I've always been very comfortable with the term queer as well. And so I use that most of the time, actually. And so yes, I would say that there's been some change, but just in the natural, and that's been informed, I think, by sort of reading, you know, quite a bit, and but being aware that these things are really changeable as well. Yeah. But I think. I don't know if Brighton has particularly had that effect on it, though, sort of my use of possibly, you know, maybe going to trans groups and things, you become more aware of certain sort of expressions and things like that. And you kind of, if you feel comfortable with these words, you then kind of adopt them, I guess. And there is a certain... You forget in a way that these are terms certainly that a lot of people would not be aware of. So, you know, so I would say, yes, I don't know if that's directly related to being in Brighton, though. But maybe Brighton is a little bit more... I know that there's a move recently to having gender neutral, is it in the council or something, forms and things like that, which is quite unique. It became a bit of a national story, I think. And this seems to be quite unique within this country anyway, to Brighton. So maybe there is some awareness. And MX, the gender neutral title, is something that that I've only learnt about since being in Brighton. So so for me, this has been... but I think this is quite unique to the situation, you know, sort of being in academia and moving in some sort of queer circles. I know there are some people very much outside of that, you know, sort of, and maybe wouldn't have those words or language, and a lot of people maybe just think they're a nonsense anyway. There's always that. So. But yes, so that's given me something to think about, actually, you know, just thinking what has changed, you know, since I've been here. A lot has changed, actually, for me personally. But, and you say language as well, and this isn't something I can kind of go into in any kind of, you know, any kind of real sense of personal knowledge. But since I've been travelling to and done a few of these conferences, I notice in Europe anyway that there's a big move. But regardless where you come from, everyone presents their paper in English. So it's made me more sensitive, you know, kind of, and more aware. There is an arrogance and an assumption, I think, that everyone will speak English. So you're aware then of this privilege of the fact that, you know, you have that. And but I come from this South Wales, where there is the Welsh language as well. I don't speak it. I didn't have the opportunity. They teach it in schools now. But when I was in school, they weren't doing that. So, but I'm also aware that it must be quite difficult. I started to think someone had mentioned something to me about the FTM group. And about the fact that there's a particular type of person there, and they were thinking racially, I think, that they seemed to think, well, is there a predominance of white people? My attitude, in a way, was, well, this is Brighton, and by the nature of it, you know, it is, you know, the most of the population are at least identified probably as mostly white. And I didn't go into the group thinking that, though, so I didn't necessarily see things in that way. But I know there's another person in the group who comes from, I think, from an Indian background and a Muslim background. And I know they've written some things that this is how they've seen it, you know, sort of this is quite clumsy, what I'm saying is kind of clumsy, but it made me aware, I suppose, that, and everyone, I think, maybe should have that awareness, that, and not just in a racial sense when it comes to these groups, but in all kinds of ways. Maybe you can't make an assumption, you know, about who's within the group. It's quite a tricky, you know, because I'm really against this idea of tokenism. Mm-hmm. But representation is very important. But I think that across a wide variety of things, you know, class, race, and then even within race, the various, you know, obviously different categories and intersections within that. And and I'm also quite aware that my cultural background, I come from a mixed background, but very much brought up with the sort of the Welsh, that this has been my experience. But I'm aware that a lot of people maybe have not come, you know, talking to my friends from different kinds of cultural backgrounds, they've maybe not had that experience, you know. So for them, even within something like an FTM group in Brighton, this might be something culturally very different. And maybe groups and certain groups could become more inclusive if they chose to be. But I'm not sure exactly. I think people find these things quite awkward. I can relate to that as well. But I think people find discussing these things to be problematic, awkward, and often fraught with all kinds of hierarchies and you know, I come from quite a unique position, I think, and I was talking to someone about this, in the sense that a foot in a few camps, you know, so I can kind of, there isn't the awkwardness, you know, if I'm addressing these issues as well with people, probably they're going to make they're going to be probably comfortable with me, whereas if this is coming from someone who's presenting or seeming to be white or identifying in that way, there can sometimes be like an awkwardness, you know, sort of. Whereas I negotiate that because of my own, the privilege, I guess, of my own, you know, sort of upbringing. But it does make me aware, though, that all kinds of situations could be much more. It should go without saying. There shouldn't be people having to fight for natural inclusion, you know, and not even just in a tokenistic way, but in a completely. And this is one of the interesting things about the Cowley. It's one of the few clubs I've been to. Maybe there are many, I don't know, but where you could be in a chair, for instance, on the dance floor, and that, even though it's a very small space, but you don't see that in a lot of places. And one of the courses I've done recently has been about disability studies. So it's kind of, I've always been kind of sensitive to that, but it's made me much more aware of that as well. And yes, but I think a lot of these things can be quite ethically, they can seem to be difficult, you know, they can seem to be. I'm lucky in a way that I've got a space that I can talk about these things, but oftentimes maybe people find having these discussions difficult even within queer community. I mean, there is so much sort of, there are so many hierarchies, the LGBTQ community in general, you know, and then certain voices that are heard obviously more than others. This is very much seen at something like Pride, very much seen in Brighton. It's, you know, obviously a privileged white male, gay male sort of gayness, which is predominant, you know, in Brighton. When I say that it is a kind of gay capital, it's in that sense. But yes, so it's just about making, you know, and I'm hoping to kind of address some of this in my own thesis, you know, sort of getting rid of some of these assumptions, and, you know, I'm kind of an idealist, I'm, you know, sort of, and quite optimistic as well, you know, about this idea of some kind of change, you know, but, you know, probably going to take a long time, but the, you know, this is the, I feel I've gone off the track a bit there.
It's lovely. Okay. What kind of change would you like to see?
Oh, as I say, complete inclusivity, these things going without saying, things like race just being seen for the, you know, sort of the man-made human-made sort of concept it is, you know. This is why I find the whole American idea of the one drop theory, where it's one drop of black blood, for instance, not one drop of white blood, and the idea of contamination through blood. And I feel one of the ways, and maybe not, that people can get or come to terms with some of these things, maybe it is within these sort of I don't know, maybe this is very idealistic, but I'm thinking about these kind of, there have always been, I don't think it's a new thing, for instance, the mixing of different groups. So maybe if there was just more of an awareness, more of, we talk about things like hidden histories. So if there was more of an opportunity to, if these were no longer hidden, but now mainstream history, so people were aware of these things, it's a very powerful thing. So I think these things need to change hugely in educational structures, power structures. There are so many things, you know, that these things are so ingrained within cultures. But I think, as we've seen in America, and I'm not being blindly idealistic about Obama and all that, but for instance, the slight change in demographics and things, people are quite surprised, I think, that Obama is appealing to, you know, sort of to many different groups. And that doesn't surprise me, because looking at his own identity and the fluidity, and I know he identifies in a monoracial way, which harks back to the one drop. But at the same time, I think people know, you know, there's an awareness that he's I think, that, for instance, one of the biggest growing ethnic groups in the UK, according to this new survey or census that's been done, is that the mixed race group, which has always been there, I think, but now there's a box on the form that people can tick, so people will become more aware. So I don't know if that will have an impact and sort of and help sort of to make some kind of changes. But this is very idealistic, and you know, and also just looking at one thing, I think. But yes, there's a lot of things I would change. You know, a lot of things obviously I would change, but certainly, yes, just more inclusive. You know, sort of a more inclusive environment for people, more representation. I mean, there are some. It's quite important, I suppose. Who you see in your books and on your screens, and you know, and how you see yourself reflected. Actually, this is why I think within a trans community, for instance, there's a magazine called Original Plumbing, and one of the interesting things is that they do have quite a variety of trans men. It isn't always the sort of the white sort of heteronormative trans guy, you know, represented, which can often be the way they seem to go out of their way, and so much so that it's more than a tokenistic gesture, I think, now. It's more the rule than the exception. And so I hope to see more of that, more people, and for my own work as well with my thesis. It can be difficult looking for films, looking for books that aren't. I mean, I was brought up with a lot. I'm writing about the tomboy identity, and most of the literature I was brought up with, and it was very natural, you know, it's not, you know, this was just the way it was, but it was often the main protagonist would be a white tomboy. I wasn't aware at the time, I didn't think in those terms, but looking at it now I can see, and I hope that there will be more of a variety of representation of different genders and identities and abilities, and sort of in film and literature, and also reflected in the educational system as well, you know, sort of, and it's very much a class-based thing as well, so, you know, so there's a lot yeah. to be changed, I think, an awful mm-hmm. lot, but I don't know.
Do we have time for it today?
Exactly, I don't think we have time to go there.
You brought some things today?
Just a couple of little things, you know. They're just personal, obviously. I've talked about I talk about these. I don't know what I want to talk about first. These were just thinking of things that are important to me, and I never knew on my father's side. My father was 10 years older than my mother, and I never knew his family lived abroad. And his parents passed away before I was born, I think, because he was already 10 years older than my mother, so they would have been quite elderly. So I didn't have grandparents. They weren't in my life, you know, and they are still to be discovered, actually. I've not seen photographs of them, for instance. But it's not so unusual. My mother, for instance, had only met one set of her grandparents because of the generation, you know, and the age. My grandmother was in her late 30s when she had my mother, so my mother, you know, so her mother wasn't alive for very long before she then sort of passed away. So my mother wasn't really brought up with her grandparents. So I'm lucky, actually, to have had, even though I didn't have the one set on my father's side, the paternal, I did have these amazing maternal grandparents that were in my life as well. And I was talking to someone recently about, this was at a workshop, and we got talking about identities and things, as you do, and if you're doing gender, and they... Oh, I didn't think of that.
I just realised.
I'm wondering, could we pause for a second? Yeah. Or?